W22 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. The Harris campaign reports $540 million in donations since it got into the race, which is a surge in donations following the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. CBS's Stacey Lynn has the story.
As the party rallied around its new ticket at the DNC, the campaign says it brought in $82 million during that week alone. And they say the best hour of fundraising was right after Harris delivered her acceptance speech.
New York Democratic Congressman Pat Ryan says the surge is not over.
I think we're the next 72 days, we're going to see that momentum continue to build.
Ryan was interviewed on CBS's Face the Nation. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham predicts the bump in enthusiasm will die down quickly following the Democrats' nominating convention. Why?
Americans are not joyful when they go to the gas station and fill up their car. They're not joyful when they make their mortgage payment. They're not joyful when they go to the grocery store.
Graham was on CNN's State of the Union. Israel has fired rockets at Hezbollah positions in Lebanon. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. tells CBS it was a preventive strike.
We identify concrete planning and preparation by Hezbollah to launch a massive missile and drone attack into Israel.
The BBC's Eileen McHugh says Hezbollah's leader remains committed to defending Hezbollah's interests as long as the war continues in Gaza between Israel and Hamas.
The leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, has said his group's attack on Israel was aimed at military sites deep inside the country. In a televised address following the latest exchange of fire across the border, he said a military intelligence and surveillance base close to Tel Aviv was targeted in response to last month's assassination of a top commander.
Talks aimed at ending the war in Gaza have resumed in Cairo, but the Hamas delegation has already left. Hawaii is waking up to a Category 1 hurricane as it passes to the south. National Weather Service forecaster Ian Morrison is in Honolulu.
They've received anywhere from 5 to 10 inches of rain over the past day or so, and we do expect for that rain to continue at least through today's morning time here in Hawaii.
A flash flood has hit Grand Canyon National Park, prompting National Guard helicopter evacuations. More than 100 tourists and tribal members are being plucked from the canyon. Packing up and heading back to school presents many challenges, including the challenge of finding affordable housing.
It's made worse by the fact that college students are often trying to live near a campus. There's price gouging going on.
That's Sarah Goldrick-Robb. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
4 Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The Inflation Reduction Act is still being implemented, and one part of it may help you pay for energy-efficient updates in your home. Here's Mike Moen.
Tax credits in the act are designed to incentivize property owners to reduce their structure's carbon footprint. But policy experts say there's still not enough awareness of the law's rollout and the available cost-sharing aid. La Crosse City Council member Mackenzie Mindell says the process is set up to avoid feeling overwhelmed.
You know, the first step is really getting that energy audit. And so there are IRA-approved contractors who will come in and do an energy audit on your house and determine for you what would be the best cost savings.
They advise income-eligible residents on which clean energy systems or appliances would be the perfect fit. Mindell says these rebates can be a big help for low-income households dealing with higher energy costs. As for the federal tax credit, some programs allow for savings of 30% for energy upgrades. Ben Evans with the U.S. Green Building Council says, as a whole, IRA incentives are pretty versatile with some mixing and matching possible.
And the beauty of the Inflation Reduction Act is that you can combine a lot of these. It's not like you have to just pick one. You can get a couple of different tax incentives for the same project. Well, let's say you're renovating a building while you're also adding some rooftop solar. You could get tax incentives for each of those.
The assistance comes amid growing pressure for policymakers to mitigate the impacts of climate change linked to fossil fuel sources. Researchers say globally, buildings account for 40% of greenhouse gas emissions, by far the largest share of any economic sector. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a partly sunny sky for your Sunday. High temperatures warming to the lower 90s. Our heat index, though, in the upper 90s. A light south to southeast wind. Tonight, partly cloudy skies and mid-70s. On Monday, mostly sunny and hot. Highs in the middle 90s. It's 87 at our studios.
Crude and Dom.
Dom and Crude return on Monday after doing double duty at the DNC last week. They'll have a recap of the convention as well as analysis of all the events that happened over the weekend.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media in our weekend venued review of law and justice and the delivery of it in America and beyond. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this, the second hour of our discussion of those and much related topics. In our first hour, doing this review of what the Supreme Court has been doing in its so-called hiatus period, not only engaging in some academic pursuits overseas, working on their own books, but also making some important decisions when it comes to the emergency docket before it, including this major case in which they said that Arizona can indeed go ahead and prohibit people who don't have proof of birth in the United States of America, don't have that kind of established evidence to show that they are indeed citizens of the United States of America. They can be denied registration in the state of Arizona. That coming out of one of the emergency docket results of the Supreme Court just this past week. Talked about the Arkansas Supreme Court refusing to permit a group to place on the ballot in November a referendum there in Arkansas that would have changed if the population had endorsed it, would have changed the situation under which abortions can in fact be legal in that state. It would have allowed for abortions up to 18 weeks after fertilization, with exceptions for incest, rape, and when a fetus is unable to survive outside the womb. That would have been a significant change in the previous law in Arkansas. Won't be on the ballot this coming November because of this finding by the Arkansas Supreme Court that the advocates for that change had failed to submit the appropriate paperwork to show how the paid canvassers to get names on the referendum application had been trained. An awful lot of focus there upon what can only be called a very technical misstep, and also refusing to let them remedy that problem, that coming out of Arkansas. And then we've got this Kansas judge, this federal judge in Wichita, finding for the first time in our nation's history that the longstanding congressional bar on machine guns in our nation is unconstitutional, and that a prosecution for someone who had possessed that kind of weapon could not go ahead because there is not a sufficient analog in history to support a prohibition on machine guns in the federal courts and in the states of the United States of America. Stunning, stunning decision, almost certainly to be appealed to the appeals court and perhaps also going on to the United States Supreme Court one day. All of that happening in decisions coming out of federal and state courts around our nation. This is Amicus, and as always, we take your calls at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, or you can also drop into the Civic Media app a question, an inquiry about anything on our syllabus, and Max and I will be certain to respond to those questions, those inquiries about the subject matter that is on our ambitious syllabus for this, our second hour of Amicus Law Review. So what is on the agenda? We're now going to turn to some prosecutions that resulted in convictions of people in some of those federal and state courts around our nation. We're going to talk about three of them in particular, all of them related to issues important to the campaign that have been a part of our recent history and that follow up on other stories that we reported on here on our broadcast every single weekend. Let's begin with another case involving January 6th, the insurrection of that day. But this one related to a lawyer in particular. The former lawyer for the Oath Keepers, remember the Oath Keepers? That's the militia that was responsible in many ways for organizing at least some portions of the assault on the Capitol. A lot we've talked about there before. The former lawyer for the Oath Keepers pled guilty this past week to advising members of that far-right militia group to illegally delete text messages after the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. That is a violation of the law. A hearing is took place this past week in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. The lawyer there, her name is Kelly Sorrell, Sorrelle, admitted in court as a part of her plea of guilty to charges there that she had tampered with evidence and had illegally entered and remained in a restricted area of the Capitol grounds. You may recall well that Donald Trump, after he lost the 2020 election, maintaining, of course, that the election was rigged. Ms. Sorrell, based in Texas, had close ties to the so-called Stop the Steal movement that incorporated and advanced that particular view. And it claimed, of course, that Donald Trump had been cheated out of victory at the time in his run against Joe Biden, our current president. This particular lawyer, again, Ms. Sorrell, also served as the general counsel, the lawyer for the Oath Keepers, and according to all court records, had a romantic relationship with the militia's leader and founder. His name, Stuart Rhodes, a name that I'm certain you recall well. We have talked a lot about what he did on January 6th before that, on that date, and the conviction that he suffered also in the wake of the prosecution by the U.S. Department of Justice. Stuart Rhodes himself, guilty at a trial in Washington of seditious conspiracy for his role in that attack. And he was sentenced to 18 years in prison. This particular lawyer, of course, advisor, general counsel to the Oath Keepers, and certainly to the founder of it. There was evidence during the course of Rhodes' trial that he, that is Stuart Rhodes and Ms. Sorrell, worked closely for several weeks organizing the Oath Keepers to descend on Washington on January 6th. That evidence during the course of the trial also showed that she was present at what you may recall was this fairly mysterious meeting in an underground parking garage. Remember this? Near the Capitol on the day before the attack. And at that time, according to the evidence in the course of the trial, both Rhodes and this fellow named Enrique Tarrio, he's a leader of the Proud Boys, yet another group. Remember all these groups, all these names? He was another far-right group that was responsible in part for the insurrection, instrumental in promoting the violence of that day. This lawyer was apparently present for that meeting between Enrique Tarrio and Stuart Rhodes in this underground parking garage. According to all the reporting, on January 6th, Ms. Sorrell accompanied Rhodes to the Capitol, although neither entered the building. Still, court papers say that after the building was stormed and dozens of the Oath Keepers came under scrutiny by federal investigators, she advised Rhodes and other members of this group to delete encrypted messages from their cell phones. And early in this investigation of what had happened here, Ms. Sorrell told reporters that she was cooperating with the Justice Department's inquiry into what the Oath Keepers had and had not done during the course of the insurrection on January 6th. She also spoke several times to staff investigators working for that House committee. Remember that House committee on January 6th? She said she worked with them as well, providing information to that committee as well. After she was charged, however, this lawyer, Ms. Sorrell, sought to avoid any trial by asserting that she was mentally incompetent. And initially, at least, the judge who's presiding over all of this, initially the trial and now her eventual plea, which she entered this past week, his name, we've heard of him before, Amit Mehta, Judge Amit Mehta, federal district court judge there in the District of Columbia, presiding over many of these prosecutions. He initially agreed with this notion that she was mentally incompetent,
But he changed his mind after she received some mental health treatment and as the case proceeded down the course of regular prosecution. During the course of all of this, there were also, of course, videos at the time showing not only the transactions on January 6th, but also evidence supporting her involvement again in encouraging the Oath Keepers to delete evidence of that is important to the prosecution itself. And of course, all of that, a part of the plea entered by her just this past week. During the course of the presentation of all of that evidence, more evidence about the fact that Ms. Sorrell had signed her name to two open letters to Donald Trump that Mr. Rhodes had posted on the Oath Keepers website. Those letters, which were introduced at Rhodes' trial, called on Donald Trump to take aggressive steps to remain in power. Those included things like invoking the Insurrection Act, which we've talked about a lot, and would have also encouraged him to mobilize militias, like those that are a part of the history of the world, if you will, to suppress a coup that was seeking to unseat him. Those trials also, again, featured prominently these text messages, some of them very salacious, between Mr. Rhodes and Ms. Sorrell, all of that coming out during the course of the trial, and now more recently, the plea of Ms. Rhodes to these federal charges, alleging that her deletion of these text messages after the violent mob attack on the Capitol on January 6th, all of that in violation of federal law. Tampering with evidence, illegally entering and remaining in a restricted area of the Capitol grounds on that day, although not officially entering that property. Significant in that lawyers, once again, finding themselves on the receiving end of criminal prosecution, in this case, a serious criminal prosecution, for their involvement in attempting to obstruct justice, to prevent information from being a part of the investigation of January 6th. Kelly Sorrell, this past week, acknowledging those charges in a federal district court in Washington, D.C., tampering with January 6th evidence of this far-right group, the Oath Keepers. We've got other information about other cases also involving January 6th, but this one not taking place in Washington, D.C., but rather in a state far to the west. We know from just recent weeks that a former Mesa County clerk out in Colorado was found guilty of four felonies after a fairly lengthy trial, marking yet another conviction tied to post-2020 election conspiracy theories, again bringing into the fold yet another person who was responsible in part for perpetuating these notions that somehow the 2020 election was stolen. The defendant in this case, Tina Peters, faced a total of 10 criminal charges related to her role in helping a man gain unauthorized access to some voting equipment there in Colorado in Mesa County during a secure software update in May of 2021. You may recall some of the reporting on this particular event at the time. The county's voting machines, passwords, and copies of its hard drive as a result of this access were later posted online by people who are trying to undermine the validity of the election system and, again, advance this unsupported conspiracy theory that somehow the 2020 election had been stolen. As we continue here on Amicus, we'll tell you what happened to Tina Peters and what she has been found guilty of and the implications of that for her future as we go on with our discussion right here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Here's a tip to make your next trip to a foreign destination more enjoyable. Try learning the language. It assists with discovering local spots to visit. Rosetta Stone offers a lifetime membership to all 25 of their languages. Try a little German, learn Japanese or Swedish. You get to prepare with Rosetta Stone. And right now, you can get 50% off Rosetta Stone's Lifetime Unlimited subscription. Visit rosettastone.com/radio today to purchase and then learn for life. That's rosettastone.com/radio.
CapTime's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this, the second hour of our weekend weekly broadcast on justice and government and the rule of law. Indeed, rule of law, the imposition of a finding of criminal culpability on Tina Peters. Tina Peters found guilty of four felonies earlier this month after a very lengthy criminal trial, facing criminal charges related to her role in helping someone gain unauthorized access to voting equipment, the information gotten as a result of that access then showing up online and being posted by people who are trying to establish that indeed the voting there in Colorado was corrupt, was not in fact the predicate for the decision ultimately with respect to the presidency of our current president, Joe Biden. Peters was found guilty of three counts of attempting to influence a public servant and one count of conspiracy to commit criminal impersonation. Also convicted of first-degree official misconduct, violation of duty, and failure to comply with an order from the Secretary of State. All of those are misdemeanors. And all of that, of course, reflects what is behind all of this. And the reason why it's so significant is that she is the clerk. She is the clerk of, former clerk now, of Mesa County there in Colorado, an official responsible for the administration of the voting there, found guilty of four felonies and also some misdemeanors. In the interest of complete disclosure, she was also acquitted by a jury on three counts, and that included criminal impersonation, conspiracy to commit criminal impersonation, and identity theft, but otherwise convicted of these felonies and also of the misdemeanors. The investigation into Clerk Peters' actions began, you may recall, almost exactly 3 years ago, when images taken during a secure update, including of some of these machine passwords, surfaced online. People began to see these things online and said, what's going on here? And at the same time, a copy of the Mesa County hard drive was displayed overtly, publicly, discussed at a cyber symposium that was hosted by, yes, Mike Lindell. He's the MyPillow CEO, has been at the center of a lot of false claims about the 2020 presidential election being stolen. Also a part of this cyber symposium, they show up there as well. Now, following all of that, of course, there's a formal investigation of all this by something called the 21st Judicial District in Mesa County. And the Colorado Secretary of State's office also asked, what's going on here? How is this otherwise non-disclosed information showing up in the public domain, online, in these symposiums? And it found that Peters began meeting with people concerned about election integrity as about in April of 2021, as she herself was promoting these conspiracy theories, prompted, of course, by the outcome of the 2020 presidential election, results of the spring 2020 Grand Junction municipal election, which also gave her concerns about the legitimacy of voting there. Peters has said that the victory of a number of more moderate candidates made her believe that something was amiss. Something was wrong, she said, with the county's Dominion voting systems. And there, once again, there's the reference to Dominion voting machines. We know well Dominion having gotten previously this major defamation judgment against Fox News for indicating that its machines were somehow responsible for skewing the vote. Dominion voting systems,
there again, being pointed to as the reason for skewed and inappropriate results, not at all the result of the actual investigation. Some of the facts in this case have never been disputed, and those were plainly a part of the presentation of trial evidence against Clerk Peters. She admitted in May of 2021 that she had in fact used the identity of a man named Gerald Wood to give a different person, another man, his name is Conan Hayes, a self-described data expert from California, access to the county voting equipment, and was doing that both to copy the hard drive and a few days later to attend the secure update of the machine's software, giving these private individuals access to things in the scope of her official duties as the clerk. Hayes is apparently a retired surfer with ties once again to Mike Lindell and his campaign of spreading what can only be described as falsehoods about the country's overall election system, including right there in Colorado. The prosecutor, in the wake of the conviction of Ms. Peters by this jury, said this case was a simple case centered around the use of deceit to commit a fraud. He went on to say, it's not about computers, it's not about election records, it's about using deceit to trick and manipulate others, specifically public servants who are simply trying to do their jobs. Prosecutors said that the update of the voting machine software is a very sensitive and secure and confidential process that Clerk Peters had violated, leading to her conviction. The prosecution had spent, according to all the court records, a huge amount of time showing that Peters knew what she had done. There was something wrong going on, that she knew that she appreciated what she was doing was wrong, based on her reaction when the security breach started to come to light. Two former staffers recalled that Peters told them that she is in serious trouble, one adding that Peters told her that she was going to jail for what she had done. That's plainly proof of intent. During the course of the trial itself, Peters also allegedly told staff involved with this plan to get burner phones and not to say anything. That, of course, in the nature of obstruction of justice, also revealing her own intent, her knowledge, her appreciation of the fact that she herself had done something wrong. The prosecutor once again saying the defendant was a fox guarding the hen house. It was her job to protect the election equipment, and she turned on it and used her power for her own advantage. The defendant, during the course of the trial, had said that wasn't the case, broke no rules. She said she did everything that was within her authority, and she meant to preserve election records, and nothing, no violations here of the law. Nonetheless, a jury finding Tina Peters, clerk of Mesa County there in Colorado, guilty of these election-related offenses having to do with her providing access to private individuals, information that is not public, that is confidential, ends up in the public domain and at seminars as a result of what she did to violate the oath of office that she took as a Mesa County clerk at the time of this elective process. Significant, again, coming in the wake of these continuing persistent notions that somehow the 2020 election was stolen. Now we've got at least two more convictions, one involving a lawyer there in Washington, D.C., tampering with evidence. Now we've got a clerk also in Mesa County, Colorado, for tampering and exposing the results, the information, private information, non-public information about the integrity of the system there in Colorado. And then related to politics generally, we also have just this past week another major plea of guilty to wire fraud and identity theft. A major plea of guilty in a federal court once again in these United States of America. The defendant in this case, much known to all of you, his name, George Santos. After all of the engagement with him, George Santos, just this past week, former congressman from New York, agreed to nearly $375,000 in restitution and will almost certainly face prison time based upon what he did. And as we continue here on Amicus Law Review, we'll talk about exactly what he pled guilty to and what the consequences of that plea will almost certainly be when he is sentenced months from now as our broadcast continues. Thank you.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, the Chippewa Valley's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
CBS News Brief. Vice President Harris's campaign says it has raised $540 million with a surge of donations during last week's Democratic National Convention in Chicago. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker reacted on CNN's State of the Union.
We are in a neck and neck race, the underdogs. It still is a Goliath out there that we're fighting.
Hamas says it has fired a rocket at Tel Aviv. It comes after Hezbollah rocket attacks. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. tells CBS they were repelled.
They launched several hundred rockets into Israel and also drones that were aimed at central Israel, and we intercepted all of them.
Ukraine's President Zelensky says he's spoken with former President Trump about the war with Russia.
I only had messages that he will support Ukraine and will do everything how to stop the war and to do everything, Ukraine be independent, European, and free.
CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Brewers beat the A's. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Colin Ray pitched his 12th victory of the year, and the Brewer bats were hot again on their way to a 9-5 win against the A's in the Oakland Coliseum. It's another series win, but Pat Murphy says there's work left to be done.
We haven't taken care of business yet, but I think we're somewhat fortunate today. But, you know, again, I like that our ball club just keeps going, and we base ran pretty well there in that last inning. We hustled, you know what I mean? And instead of being tired, it's 130 games in and just jogging, you know, like, we hustled.
NFL, the Packers beat the Ravens at Lambeau Field 30-7, but the place kicker competition remains up in the air. Greg Joseph and Anders Carlson each converted field goals from beyond 50 yards out, but later Carlson shanked one wide right on a 32-yard attempt. Matt LaFleur.
Both those guys went in there and hit a 54-yarder and a 55-yarder, and then there's a poor moment there where we miss a chip shot.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a partly sunny sky for your Sunday. High temperatures warming to the lower 90s. Our heat index, though, in the upper 90s. A light south to southeast wind. Tonight, partly cloudy skies and mid-70s. On Monday, mostly sunny and hot. Highs in the middle 90s. Currently 89 degrees.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. I want to talk today to the folks who are trying to decide between funding their retirement or funding their kids' future education. Because for a lot of us, this is an either-or choice. And I'm here to tell you, or just to give you permission, to fund your retirement before a 529 or another school-specific savings plan. Why? Well, your kids can borrow money for their education, and they might get scholarships or grants to help them pay for it. But there aren't loans to help you pay for retirement. And while Social Security will be there to support you, most of us want or need to live on a little more than what Social Security provides. And if you don't save for retirement, your kids could ultimately end up on the hook paying for your care. Taking care of you is also taking care of them. For more everyday money tips, check out Work Money Media on YouTube. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Pickleball. Yeah. Where's Greg Baca on this? Because I'm about to offend all these many, many people in Wisconsin who play it. It's overgrown ping pong. I mean, come on.
It's underbaked tennis.
Well, I've already done it because on the text line, Matt from Germantown, don't make fun of pickleball.
We're not making fun of pickleball. We're simply making fun of the people who play pickleball. There is a difference.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Angela Lang, the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, is my guest host for the day. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Jim Santel. I am your host for Amicus Law Review as we continue this weekend our exposition, our flight through a number of different cases, including now the defendants who have been found guilty and have pled guilty in various courts throughout our nation, including George Santos, the former congressman from New York, had a penchant, an inclination to lie about many, many things in his life, and creating one of the oddest sideshows in modern U.S. politics, pleading guilty just this past week to wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. This particular plea allows him, of course, to avoid a trial in a total of nearly two dozen charges, almost 24 charges. Those included money laundering, stealing public funds in this case. But it also ensures that George Santos will probably face at least 2 years in federal prison. Almost certainly ensures that, and could be as long as two decades, although it's unlikely the judge will sentence him to that type of sentence in this case. George Santos appeared in court just this past week. He had previously insisted, of course, that he would defend his innocence in court, and he had previously spoken about all of the litigation against him, the prosecution against him, as a witch hunt. Of course, echoing Donald Trump's defense of his own legal troubles, Santos all but reversing that when he was in court early this week. He, on Monday, plainly taking the position that his previous statements about not being involved in any of this and planning to defend against all this no longer a part of his plan. On Monday, the bravado, if you will, that he showed was replaced by what everybody reported as a kind of a wavering voice. Words of contrition. He said this. He said, "I accept full responsibility for my action," telling the judge, as he admitted to participating in this scheme to artificially inflate the number of contributions to his campaign to win support from the National Republican Congressional Committee. He went on to say, "I understand my actions have betrayed the trust of my supporters and of my constituents." And along the way, of course, this prosecution was premised upon many of the campaign violations that were the results of the investigation. They painted George Santos' campaign as so desperate for cash that it turned to lying and cheating and stealing to finance its basic core operations. The prosecutors had also, during the course of this case, again, didn't go to trial, but presented during the course of the change of plea hearing of earlier this week, they also asserted a pattern of self-dealing. Santos repeatedly using his campaign account as a personal, would only be called a piggy bank. They said that Santos used one donor's credit card information to steal about $11,000 for his personal use, convinced other donors to contribute to what he said was a super PAC supporting his campaign. Instead, in fact, he used some of the money to buy designer clothing and pay his personal credit card bills. Accused of falsifying campaign finance records to include a $500,000 loan to his campaign that never existed, again, in order to qualify for financial support from the National Republican Party. That's what he was talking about at the time of his acknowledgement of the offense conduct. His campaign treasurer, Nancy Marks, previously admitted to having helped Santos falsify those records. She already pleaded guilty to one felony count in October. She's facing 4 years in prison for doing all of this. And as if that's not enough, Santos also charged with unemployment fraud and lying on House financial disclosure documents. Many, many things here as a result of his misstatements, his false statements, his misuse of campaign funds, and his failure to report all of this accurately. Recall that the criminal investigation into George Santos began after it was the New York Times that had reported much of the biography of George Santos was not just suspect, but frankly, simply wrong. Aspects of his campaign finances appeared to have been fabricated. And all of that, you will recall well, began to unravel as more and more reporters looked at who this fellow was, what he had done in his past, and specifically what he had done during the course of his campaign. Santos was charged then with 23 felony counts, number of different schemes involving all of this, stealing money from donors, lying to the government to cover his tracks,
and had pleaded guilty, not guilty to all of those charges until once again this past week when he acknowledged that he had done much, if not all, of this. Significantly, the sentencing here is postponed until February 7th, meaning that he won't report to prison for at least 6 months during this period of time. Of course, a pre-sentence report will be prepared for the judge to take a look at, determine exactly what kind of a sentence will be imposed upon this former congressman. The sentencing guidelines that we talk about routinely on this broadcast call for him to serve as many as 8 years in prison. 8 years. But it's highly unlikely the judge is going to impose that kind of a sentence, much more lenient, but probably a couple of years in prison. And again, could be much more than that, depending upon what the judge in his discretion under the guidelines establishes and what he decides to do. Significantly, already indicated that George Santos has agreed to pay restitution. That specific amount, $373,749.97, and to forfeit another $205,002.97 before his sentencing. He's got to come up with that money for his final plea deal to come through in the times just ahead. And if he's unable to do that, as we've seen in other cases, he is going to have to be subjected to property seizures and also attempts by the state, by the federal government, to impose the liens upon him that will ensure the collection of those amounts of money. A significant financial penalty coming up here, and also almost certainly in February of next year, the imposition of some time in prison for this former congressman, now convicted. The presumption of innocence no longer attends him. Now convicted of these federal offenses in federal court, his presumption of innocence no longer with him, and facing now some serious time in prison along with these significant amounts of restitution in this prosecution going forward. George Santos, now a convicted felon for the things that he has said and done in connection with violations of federal law and also misrepresentations to his donors and the campaign process generally. We appreciate so much here on Amicus Law Review the inquiries and questions of our listeners. That number, of course, 844-967-2789. You can also go on the Civic Media app and send to Max and me your question or your inquiry. And we have online right now Mark calling in with questions or inquiries about our subjects this morning on our broadcast. Mark, glad to have you with us.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I'm kind of curious. Well, so many things. The machine gun thing just kind of drives me nuts.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Responsible firearm owner. It just is insane. But under the Constitution, I mean, that we do have the right to vote in the Constitution. And there's also a prohibition on poll taxes in the Constitution. I think that's,
yes,
24, I think.
Right, and Supreme Court has, again, not only legislatively that's been prohibited, but also by the Supreme Court. You can't impose monies to vote in America. Just can't do that. Poll tax is unconstitutional, right?
No, it costs money to get a copy of your birth certificate. And how does Arizona's new thing requiring you to get a copy of your birth certificate that actually avoid the whole poll tax question, which the Supreme Court ducks on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
I mean, the whole machine gun thing, the one thing brought to mind that there's words I cannot say on the air right now, even though I would like to say it right now, because they're prohibited under law.
Right.
That, you know, George Carlin's seven words. Those are not deadly words. They're not going to kill anybody. But this nitwit judge down in Arkansas said, well, you can have a machine gun now and mow down, you know, multiples of people with one of those things. We decided to use, you know, that how can they actually honestly say, come out and say, and you probably can't answer this, say, well there's no restrictions on firearms in general, but you can restrict free speech. And that's the part that is kind of baffling to me.
The inconsistencies here between one set of standards and the other, right?
Correct. And perhaps this will require a whole hour, probably, but the prohibitions, the sanctions against when you violate somebody's right to vote under 14.2 of the U.S. Constitution, when the right to vote is denied or anyway abridged, it goes on there to say what the penalties are for abridging those rights. And I don't quite understand that under 14.2. It's a little arcane talking about the decrease in the representation or the enumeration for representation. I don't know that I have the language right in front of me right now. But it would be interesting to see what kind of sanctions the Constitution actually says are supposed to happen when rights are denied, right to vote is denied.
Right. And we know that the Voting Rights Act, of course, we've talked a lot about it, you and I and other listeners, and certainly in this broadcast, all sorts of things that envision, contemplate access to the polls. And again, focusing on your concern, my as well, I suspect many of other listeners out there, Arizona says, you know, before you can even register, you have got to get this proof of citizenship. Thankfully, the Supreme Court does not uphold the portion of the law that also requires that people who are presently registered there also have to come forward if they want to vote in the presidential election or cast ballots by mail. So they decide go in two different ways here. But again, it's an attempt to try to prevent people from registering and therefore voting, certainly inconsistent with the tenor, the spirit of the Voting Rights Act, and as you said, the Constitution itself. Very troubling in a number of different areas, Mark, and appreciate very much your comments on all of this, including machine guns. You indicated you have said this before, you're a responsible gun owner. The notion that somehow machine guns are not prohibited and cannot be prohibited by the Congress as a way of keeping us safe and secure, an absurd result. Hopefully, the appeals court in the federal court system will overturn that decision. Otherwise, underscores the silliness, the frivolity of this standard now established by the Supreme Court that in order to justify restrictions on firearms, you have to look to the past, you have to look to history, and you've got to come up with an analog, something analogous, just a ridiculous notion, instead of embracing the notion of a living constitution alive today that responds to the particular instances and the particular trappings of our lives today. So, Mark, appreciate very much all of that commentary as we think through what judges are doing in all of these different areas, all of them, once again, significant in the midst of our present campaign for the presidency and other elective offices in Wisconsin and in the United States of America. Another issue that is also relevant to the present campaigns in all of those venues, of course, is the notion of housing and renter rights and tenant rights, landlord rights as well, certainly, but the notion of the access that we should all have to adequate housing in America, a focus of an awful lot of attention, certainly in recent campaigns and the recent conventions. In a speech just last month, Vice President Kamala Harris, now the Democratic nominee for president, cited concerns about collusion among corporate landlords involving price-setting software and an anti-competitive practice that drives up rental costs, making this issue of rents and the amounts of monies that landlords can exact from their tenants a major issue in this campaign. And sure enough, just this past week, the United States Department of Justice, not in a political setting, but based upon evidence gathered, premised upon the laws that it, in fact, can invoke, the antitrust laws that the Antitrust Division of Maine Justice can, in fact, invoke. Justice Department, through the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, filed an antitrust suit in federal court against a real estate software company, and alleging specifically an illegal pricing scheme facilitated by algorithms inside that software promoted by this particular company. Now, what's this all about? Well, the lawsuit filed on Friday of this past week against a company called RealPage, all one word, R-E-A-L, capital P-A-G-E, alleged that its software enabled landlords to collude, to get together, to raise rents across the United States of America. The lawsuit that was joined by North Carolina and California, Colorado, Connecticut, Minnesota, Oregon, Tennessee, and Washington accuses this company, again called RealPage, of facilitating a price-fixing conspiracy that boosted rents beyond what would be normal market prices for quite literally millions of people in America. It's the first major lawsuit, according to my research, where the role of an algorithm in pricing manipulation is central to the case, and it's also significant that Attorney General Merrick Garland comes out and says Americans should not have to pay more rent because a company has found a new way to scheme with landlords to break the law. When we return here on Amicus, more about this new lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit involving rents for tenants in America.
93.5 The Tap.
As a network, we're called Civic Media because a big part of it is we want to start modeling how civic discourse really should happen and being respectful of each other's opinions, even if you disagree, you know, like they should be given a platform.
If Rocker and I can get along, right. We can all get along.
I know,
along.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Rocker?
Yeah, that's right, Jimmy.
Well, you do have a wall in between the two of you, so
glass.
It's like the
it's only glass.
It's only tear down the walls. Listen to Max Inc. Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Eau Claire, 93.5 The Tap, and on the Civic Media app.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WCFW website at wcfw.fm. Your news just for the Eau Claire area. I'm James Kelly with WCFW News.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, talking now in this, our last segment of our weekend broadcast, about this major news civil lawsuit, not criminal lawsuit, civil lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice, the Antitrust Division, alleging this company called RealPage used some software, used an algorithm that enabled landlords nationwide to collude to raise rents across the United States of America. Now, how does this come about? Well, the RealPage software, it's called YieldStar, YieldStar, gathers confidential real estate information at the heart of the government's concerns in this case, unmistakably in the civil complaint. Landlords who pay to use this particular software share the information about rents and occupancy rates that is otherwise confidential. And based upon that data, again, according to the allegations in this antitrust lawsuit, an algorithm generates suggestions for what landlords should charge renters. And those figures, and here's the rub, here's the significant portion of this, those figures produced by this algorithm and this process are often higher than what they would otherwise be in a competitive market. There's the competition angle, according to allegations again in this complaint. The lawsuit filed in the Middle District of North Carolina accuses RealPage of monopolizing the market for software that landlords use to set these prices for those apartments. The company, RealPage, has denied the allegations of any illegal conclusion, arguing that landlords are not obliged to accept its software suggestions when setting rents, and that other economic factors are to blame for driving up rents nationwide. But nonetheless, the political implications of this in the present campaign are unmistakable. The cost of housing has become a political issue. In lead up to the November election, rent increases have been a driver of unusually strong inflation. And annual rent growth nationally peaked at nearly 16% in early 2022, according to some of the data that is out there. And so the RealPage situation here, the complaint, the antitrust complaint against this company using this algorithm arguably to illegally fix prices among landlords nationwide, going to be a part of the campaign as well. Even as that lawsuit proceeds, no way, of course, that the lawsuit's going to be resolved before the election in November, but a part of the overall view about tenancy, about landlords, tenants, they're the people who occupy residences around our nation in that landlord-tenant type of situation. The case, again, involving this company called RealPage and its particular software called YieldStar. More of that, of course, as we continue to focus on things in litigation impacting the campaign going forward. A couple of more rule of law snapshots as we go forward. Also note this past week that Texas and 15 other Republican-led states have sued the Biden administration, seeking to halt that new program that could give legal status to hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who are married to U.S. citizens. The suit, which was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas, seeks a temporary restraining order on the Biden plan and seeks a preliminary injunction to suspend the program. Court filing says that the program is illegal because it exceeds the discretion of the executive branch to set policy. The Biden administration itself says that the lawsuit aims to separate American citizens from their spouses and stepchildren who are already eligible for lawful permanent residency and who could remain together throughout this process. So lots of dispute about what the implications of this plan are and the impact of the lawsuit challenging the plan as it goes forward there in eastern Texas. A spokesman for the Homeland Security, which is running the program, said the agency would defend the program in court and continue to process new applications. Significant to note that under the new policy, again, that provides this special consideration for the spouses, the undocumented spouses of documented and U.S. citizens here, the undocumented immigrants married to U.S. citizens, this policy could affect up to 500,000 undocumented spouses and could shield them from deportation and provide them, as Homeland Security says, with a pathway to citizenship and permission to work legally in the United States of America. Program signed by President Biden on June 18th, one of the most expansive actions to assist undocumented immigrants since DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, was enacted 12 years ago, continues to be the subject, as we know well, of a lot of litigation out there. The program, again, a part of a pathway for these individuals to U.S. citizenship. The new program allows them to skip certain steps that make it more difficult to achieve that result and provide this mechanism for becoming United States citizen. Now the subject of a request to enjoin it, to stop it, even as it goes forward and applications for it are underway. Finally, here on our weekend broadcast, a reference to previous reporting about overseas elections. We recall well the situation in Venezuela and some follow-up news there in the wake of the presidential election there involving Nicolas Maduro claiming a victory there when all of the other indications there, including international reporting, including that of our own Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, reflecting the generally accepted view that there was huge, massive voter fraud there. Maduro maintaining that the votes came back wildly in his favor. And just this past week, Venezuela's Supreme Court backing Nicolas Maduro and saying that the voting tallies published online do in fact show that Nicolas Maduro won the election. The ruling, the latest attempt by Maduro, again, to blunt protesters out there and to blunt international criticism that erupted after the July 28th vote, in which he proclaimed himself the victor in that election, a third six-year term. The decision by the Supreme Court read Thursday, an event attempted by senior officials and foreign diplomats, came in response to a request by Maduro to review those vote totals, showing that he had won by more than 1 million votes. Obviously, others throughout the nation and across the face of the planet have contradicted that result, saying the findings of experts, United Nations, the Carter Center, others observing the election determined that the results announced by the authorities lacked any credibility. The outside experts noting that the authorities didn't release a breakdown of the results of each of the 30,000 voting booths nationwide and indicating once again that the results of the election there were not as published as reported by the government. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court of Venezuela putting its imprimatur on those election results just this past week, Nicolas Maduro remaining the president another term as the president of Venezuela going forward. I thank you for listening once again to Amicus Law Review this weekend and every weekend here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Join us again next week for everything related to government, the rule of law, and the administration of justice in our nation and around the world. Have a good week, everybody.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel entertainment reporter Chris Foran joins the show to talk movies and TV. And Wisconsin native comedian Mary Mack joins the show to talk about her tour of the state.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Do you know or work with kids who have special healthcare needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential.
Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/WISCWAY. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.